Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this next half-hour segment, we're going to take a look at a subject that I've dealt with before on other half-hour segments and also in a long interview with Drs. Alan Cantwell, Leonard Horowitz, Garth Nicholson, and Ed Haslam, author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, namely Gulf War Syndrome. At the same time, we're going to be revisiting the very first of my archive programs that I did on May 23rd, 1980. That program is entitled Uncle Sam and the Swastika. The title of the broadcast, the focus, I should say, of the program is Gulf War Syndrome. And we're going to begin by taking a look at an article from the New York Times of Tuesday, November 18th of 1997. This article is by Alan Cowell, C-O-W-E-L-L, of the New York Times. It's datelined Bonn, November 17th of 1997, and is headlined, German Official Spied for Iraq in Gulf War. Shortly after, the article reads in part as follows. Shortly after Saddam Hussein's army marched into Kuwait in August of 1990, a German foreign ministry official provided Baghdad with piles of secrets, including Western assessments of Iraq's missile strength. The German official, who also gave Iraq critical insights into the increasing deployment of United States forces, was eventually arrested and convicted of espionage, according to confidential documents from his trial. The documents suggest that President Hussein had far greater knowledge in 1990 of American and Allied thinking than was publicly assumed at the time. And the information provided by the German spy may have helped Iraq protect from Allied air attack some of the missiles it used to attack Israel in 1991, the court documents say. By the way, I would also add parenthetically that it may also have permitted the Iraqis to launch some airburst scuds, some of which some Gulf War veterans believe may have helped to infect them with CBW agents, including the genetically altered mycoplasma that the doctors Garth and Nancy Nicholson have discovered is involved in Gulf War syndrome. Continuing, the spy, Jürgen Mohammed Geitler, G-I-E-T-L-E-R, 42, is said to have given an Iraqi intelligence officer in Bonn details of a confidential message from President George Bush to Chancellor Helmut Kohl that set out United States military deployments in the Persian Gulf, in the Persian Gulf region. He also handed over a German intelligence report setting out what the West knew about the location of Iraqi Scud B missile sites, according to the court documents. In other words, President Hussein had time to relocate missile launchers or replace them with decoys long before the beginning of Allied air raids against Iraq in January of 1991. Quote, the subsequent course of the war, the targeting of heavily populated residential areas of Israel by Iraqi rockets, shows the great significance of this report for Iraq and for the coalition against it, unquote, the documents say. Bonn has a reputation as a place easily penetrated by hostile intelligence agencies. But even by those standards, Mr. Geitler's dealings with an Iraqi military intelligence officer seem to have been made easy by extraordinarily lax security arrangements at the foreign ministry where he worked in the registry where documents are stored. I do not know if Klaus Kinkel, former head of BND, was in charge of the foreign ministry at that time, but one of the possibilities I think that should be very seriously considered is perhaps that individual, when he was prosecuted, simply received a wrist slap and may have been functioning in an official capacity for the German National Security Establishment. I have touched on that speculative element because there is a history of support for Middle Eastern nationalist movements, including Pan-Arabist nationalist movements by Germany, both certain Pan-Arabist movements, including the movement led by Haj Amin al-Husseini, the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, who was also an SS officer and a German spy. Some of those Middle Eastern nationalist movements found a common cause with the Third Reich prior to and during World War II, because they had the common goals of not only getting Great Britain out of the Middle East, Great Britain being the dominant colonial power in that area, but also impeding or eliminating Zionism. That common goal led to not only some formal alliances between elements of the Third Reich and elements of Middle Eastern nationalist movements, but it also led to a certain extent to the development of the Ba'athist Party in Iraq. That was discussed in a book called The Death Lobby, How the West Armed Iraq. That book was authored by Kenneth R. Timmerman, T-I-M-M-E-R-M-A-N, who writes for, among other publications, The Wall Street Journal, or who has. The book was published in hardcover and copyright 1991, and it was published by Houghton Mifflin and Company. The ISBN number is 0-395-59305-0. And of the affinity between and, to a certain extent, ideological alliance between the Third Reich and the Ba'athist Party, a pan-Arabist party, and that obviously the party in Iraq headed up by Saddam Hussein, the author writes as follows. Unlike Europe, the Middle East was not transformed into a pile of smoldering rubble by World War II. The Nazi conflagration left Arab dreams and Arab resentments intact. By the time he was 8, Saddam had already marshaled the boys of his village into a mock militia that marched up and down the dusty streets of Tikrit, T-I-K-R-I-T, with wooden guns. At 10, he found a mentor in his maternal uncle, Khairallah Al-Tulfa, a recently cashiered army officer whose hatred of British colonial rule was matched only by his admiration for Adolf Hitler and his Nazi ideals. By the way, that man's last name, Al-Tulfah. More about him later. Saddam turned to his uncle at least in part because of problems at home. His father had deserted the family when Saddam was a young child, and his mother's second husband, an illiterate shepherd named Ibrahim Hassan, beat the boy whenever he refused to tend the sheep. When he was 12, Saddam took refuge in his uncle Khairallah's house. He learned to read by the light of an oil lamp and fed his spirit on his uncle's tales of exploits with pro-German officers in the Iraqi army. Khairallah Al-Tulfah had a dream that Arabs would one day be free of foreign occupation and foreign rule. The Germans, Khairallah said, were the only ones who respected the Arabs as equals. The British were just after their oil. Skipping down, the Ba'ath Party, or the Party of Arab Renaissance, called for the creation of a single Arab political union that would reach from North Africa to the border of Iran. Formed in 1947 in response to the emerging state of Israel, the party fired the imagination of many young Iraqis like Saddam Hussein al-Tikriti. For the young Ba'athists, the event that forever fixed their way of looking at the world was, quote, the takeover of Palestine by international Zionism, unquote. As one Ba'athist writer put it, the influx of Jews to Palestine during the Holocaust in Europe, quote, was bound to generate a great deal of bitterness, resentment, and hostility. This sort of feeling naturally led certain sectors of the Arab public opinion to sympathize with the Axis powers, unquote. British colonialism bore immense responsibility for the, quote, disaster, unquote, of Palestine, the Ba'athists felt, and in their speeches and ideological writings they consistently identified the two. Quote, it is our unshakable belief, unquote, the founder of the Ba'ath Party, Michel Aflaq, M-A-F-L-A-K, wrote in 1956, again quoting, that if the battle takes place sooner or later, it will be to liberate not Palestine alone, but the whole of the Arab homeland. The struggle for freedom from British domination and the pro-British regime then in power throughout the Arab world was to become, as Saddam would put it later, the mother of all battles, unquote. One facet of Ba'athist ideology helps shed some light on the origin of Saddam Hussein's political beliefs. To the Ba'athists, the Arab world formed a single nation united by language, culture, and religion. That religion was Islam, the Ba'ath founders insisted, even though they themselves were Christians. Opposed to this Arab, quote, nation, unquote, which had been splintered by an imperialist conspiracy, were the Arab regions, the nation-states that had come into being during the 20th century, whose borders the Ba'athists considered as artificial relics of the colonial era. When the Ba'athists talked about the regional command, they meant the Iraqi or the Syrian Ba'ath party, whereas the national command referred to a theoretical body where regional leaders from the various Arab states would meet to determine the fate of the larger nation, unquote. Like many prophets before them, the early Ba'athists believed that their prayers would become flesh in the body of a great leader, a man destined to rule the Arab nation with an iron will. Under his leadership, 50 million Arabs would rise up and expel the Jews and the colonial powers from the Middle East. Until then, the Arab world would remain fragmented, weak, and submissive. Hero worship was not the only similarity between the Ba'athist and Nazi ideologies. Both believed in racial identity, in foreign devils, and in war as purification. As Aflaq wrote on the eve of his party's creation, when the ashes of the Nazi dream had not yet gone cold, quote, real struggle can never be destruction, negativeness, or inaction. It is creativeness, a building, a fruitful and positive action, unquote. War was great, the young Baathists surrounding Saddam believed. Long live its purifying fire. And bear in mind some of the ideological similarities between the Baathist Party and the Nazi Party of Germany. I would note that the ethnocentrism of the Baath Party also is an element of commonality with the Zionist movement itself. And bear in mind the German who spied for Iraq. What we're going to do next is to listen to a section of the very first of my archive shows, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, from May 23rd of 1980. And what we're going to do is listen to a section about that archive show about the recapitalization of Germany under the Dawes and Young plan, and in particular pay attention to two companies, one IG Farben and also Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or United Steel. We're going to come back to these, and we're going to take a look at the role of some of the same corporations that were involved in the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that was instrumental not only in helping to bring fascism to Germany, but also that was instrumental in that basically provided Hitler with his war-making industries. Because many of those same corporations, part of that transatlantic financial and industrial axis, were operant again prior to and during the Persian Gulf War. Again, what we're going to hear now is a section from Uncle Sam and the Swastika, recorded May 23rd of 1980. Into this gap stepped a group of diplomats who were also key international financiers. Many of the most important of them were American. Their solution to the problem of German reparations was to arrange for a series of foreign loans in order to enable Germany to continue the reparations payments. These loans were set up under two different programs. One was called the Dawes Plan, D-A-W-E-S, of 1924. The other was called the Young Plan, and that was instituted in 1929. Now, between 1924, and 1931, under the Dawes and Young Plan, Germany paid out a total of 36 billion marks in reparations. In the meantime, during that same period of time, they borrowed 33 billion marks, of course, at a great profit to the institutions lending them, so that the net payment by Germany was only 3 billion marks over the seven-year period. Now, what this had the effect of doing was to concentrate economic power, because in the harsh conditions which the Dawes and Young plan imposed, the businesses which best survived were those that had access to the American loans. It was a very effective device for eliminating competition. And in fact, some of the firms used their loans in order to buy out their competition in Germany by paying higher than market prices. The chief result of the concentration of economic power which stemmed from the conditions set up by the aforementioned Dawes and Young plan was the formation of three giant cartels, one of them the IG Farben industry, which we were talking about a while ago. That was a chemical concern. The second was Vereinigte Stahlwerke, or United Steel. And the third was German General Electric, 30% owned, by the way, by American GE. These three companies comprised the backbone of German defense production. They essentially were Hitler's tools for forging the Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe. And it's also important to note that these same industrial concerns played a key role in financing Hitler's takeover in 1933. So remember the names I.G. Farben and Vereinigte Stahlwerke. I.G. Farben, the huge and immensely important German dyestuffs industry, was the parent company that not only provided the backbone of Hitler's war-making production, they also made the Zyklon B that was used in the gas chambers in the concentration camps during World War II. We're going to turn now to a book called The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben. That book was authored by Joseph Borkin, last name B-O-R-K-I-N, published in hardcover by the Free Press, copyright 1978. And what we're going to, actually, before we get to that, I want to read a portion of a list of the companies that are being sued, or defendants, all but one of which are companies that are being sued by veterans of the Persian Gulf War. There are some 83 companies. The vast majority of them, by the way, are either German, European, or from a neutral country. About 20 of them or so are American corporations, although many of these are obviously American subsidiaries of foreign corporations. Some 33 of these corporations are German. This is the list, again, of defendants in a class action suit that is being pursued by Persian Gulf War Syndrome, or a Gulf War veteran suffering from Gulf War Syndrome. This list as of March 1st, 1996. By the way, this list is being circulated by Joyce Riley. That is a nurse who had tended some Gulf War veterans and contracted Gulf War Syndrome. Joyce Riley can be reached by fax at area code 713-438-4581. That's 713-438-4581. By voicemail at 713-587-5437. That's 713-587-5437. You can write to registered nurse Joyce Riley, last name R-I-L-E-Y, at 2931 Highland Lakes, Missouri City, Texas, 77459. That's 2931 Highland Lakes, Missouri City, Texas, 77459. Now, in this list of companies, companies numbers 34 through 38. Now, again, these are companies being sued by the Gulf War veterans are, and reading numbers 34 through 38, number 34, Degussa AG, German company. Number 35, Degussa Antwerpen NV, Belgian company. Number 36, Degesch GmbH, German company. Number 37, Detia Degesch GmbH, German company. And 38, Degesch America Incorporated, Delaware Corporation, primary place of business in Texas. Now, the names Degesch and Degussa will ring very familiar to veterans or to students of World War II history. These are subsidiaries or companies controlled by IG Farben, and they made the Zyklon B for the concentration camps in World War II. Turning again to the book, The Crime and Punishment of IG Farben, authored by Joseph Borkin, B-O-R-K-I-N, and published in hardcover by the Free Press, copyright 1978. Talking about the use of Zyklon B, an insecticide, on concentration camp victims at Auschwitz. Only one firm, Deutsche Gesellschaft für, and I'm not going to even attempt this, German Corporation for Pest Control, known in the trade as Degesch, that's one that's among the companies being sued by the Gulf War veterans, supplied this lethal chemical. Again, that's Degesch, D-E-G-E-S-C-H. Continuing, the firm and its most valuable asset, the monopoly of Zyklon B manufacture, was owned 42.5% by IG Farben Industry, 42.5% by Deutsche Gold und Silberscheidenschalt, known as Degussa, D-E-G-U-S-S-A, in which IG owned a third, and 15% by Theo Goldschmidt concern. That IG dominated Degesch was general knowledge in the chemical industry. In fact, in its official corporate pronouncements, Degesch described itself as an exclusive selling agent for IG. Moreover, IG dominated the Degesch supervisory board. Of its 11 members, 5 were from IG, including the chairman, Wilhelm Mann, capital M-A-N-N. 5 months after Hess's introduction of Zyklon B, Himmler's personal program to exterminate the Jewish people was transformed into the official policy of the Third Reich. And again, Degesch and Degussa, two of the companies being sued by the Gulf War veterans. Skipping down, more about the adaptive use of the Zyklon B, a pesticide. In the past, the SS had brought moderate amounts of Zyklon B from Degesch as a vermin control in its concentration camps. When the final solution added Jews to the SS extermination plans, Degesch profits reflected the new prosperity. IG's dividends on its Degesch investments for the years 1942, 3, and 4 were double those of 1940 and 41. At least one top official of Degesch, Gerhard Peters, the managing director, definitely knew about the new use of Zyklon B. He had been specifically informed of the details of the final solution by Kurt Gerstein, the chief disinfection officer of the SS, who did the purchasing of Zyklon B. there was still another episode that gave the officials of Degesh more than a hint of the dread purpose to which their Zyklon B was being put by the SS. When manufactured as a pesticide, Zyklon B contained a special odor or indicator to warn human beings of its lethal presence. The inclusion of such a warning odor was required by German law. When the SS demanded that the new, large order of Zyklon B omit the indicator, no one familiar with the workings of the SS could have failed to realize the purpose behind the strange request. The Degesh executives at first were unwilling to comply, but compassion was not behind their refusal. What troubled them was the fact that the SS request endangered Degesh's monopoly position. The patent on Zyklon B had long since expired. However, Degesh retained its monopoly by a patent on the warning odor. To remove the indicator was bad business, opening up the possibility of unwelcome competition. The SS made short shrift of this objection, and the company removed the warning odor. Now, the doomed would not even know it was Degesh's Zyklon B. Note again, Degesh and Degussa that produced the Zyklon B being sued by the Gulf War veterans. Note also that it was a pesticide. There is a searing irony about that, because in helping to develop Saddam Hussein's chemical and biological warfare capability, once again, the ironic use of, quote, pesticides, unquote, came into being from a propagandistic standpoint. Recalling the section of the Death Lobby, How the West Armed Iraq, by Kenneth Timmerman, that I read earlier in this broadcast, recall Saddam Hussein's uncle and ideological mentor, the pro-Nazi Khairallah al-Tulfah. He became one of the founding, one of the ideological pivots of the Ba'ath Party, and also became fantastically wealthy. Speaking of the extremely wealthy Khairallah al-Tufah, by the way, he was not only Saddam's uncle, he was also his father-in-law, worth some $500 million and in control through his wife of some 17 companies. But speaking of Khairallah al-Tufah, Kenneth Timmerman writes, "But money was not enough for the aging patriarch. In 1981, he decided it was time to make his contribution to eternal Ba'ath Party doctrine as well. He penned a scurrilous pamphlet that was widely distributed by local party cells. Its title was long but explicit: Three God Should Not Have Made, Persians, Jews, and Flies. Persians, al-Tufah wrote, were animals God created in the shape of humans, unquote. Jews were a mixture of the dirt and leftovers of diverse peoples, unquote. As for flies, they were a trifling creation, quote, whom we do not understand God's purpose in creating, unquote. For all three, the Ba'ath Party had a solution which it broadcast throughout the Arab world thanks to the powerful French transmitters of Baghdad's Voice of the Masses. Quote, there was a certain insecticide for every type of insect, unquote, Baghdad Radio proclaimed. It was an Iraqi attempt at humor. Like most Ba'ath Party jokes, its punchline was death. The German community in Baghdad was thriving, and West German trade with Iraq was up. More than 100 German companies were doing business with Baghdad. Dozens maintained full-time offices in the Iraqi capital. One was Karl Kolb GmbH, a medium-sized chemicals concern from Dreieich, a trading estate close to the Frankfurt airport. By the way, that firm, Karl Kolb, is the number 68 on the list of companies being sued by the Gulf War veterans, and this being circulated by Joyce Riley. Continuing, its Baghdad representative was a 55-year-old German named Klaus Franzl, F-R-A-N-Z-L. Franzl was more than just a sales representative. Court documents show he was a major shareholder in the Karl Kolb company, having provided 540,000 Deutschmarks in startup capital. Franzl had been working in Baghdad for years and knew Ammar al-Sadi and the Ba'athists well. One of his favorite hangouts was a belly-dancing joint called the Al-Wiya Club, where patrons could drink French champagne and eat mazgouf while rubbing shoulders with some of the regime's most senior officials. This may be where he first heard of the Samara project, one of the two pesticide plants that Ammar al-Sadi planned to build. In the months following the Israeli raid on Osirak, Franzl succeeded in having his company appointed as the main contractor for that plant. While the Samara deal was certainly worth millions to Franzl and his colleagues, it may have appealed to him for other reasons as well. Customs investigators who searched Franzl's home in Dreieich years after Samara had become a synonym for death found a large oil painting that showed Franzl wearing a Wehrmacht order from the Third Reich on his chest. Like Anton Ierlies, his sympathy for Saddam Hussein's regime appears to have gone far beyond his taste for the excellent wages the Iraqis paid. Franzl's partners in Germany were all younger men. The most important was Helmut Mayer, M-A-I-E-R, managing director for Karl Kolb. Born on December 28, 1932, Mayer was too young to have fought in the Wehrmacht, but he was old enough to remember Germany's Nazi past. Mayer and Franzl contracted with a recently created Iraqi entity, the State Establishment for Pesticides Production, or SEPP, to build an entire chemical weapons complex at Samarra. Of course, the planned use of the Kolb facilities was never mentioned in the contract. For the two Germans, and for the host of subcontractors who helped build Samarra, this was merely a plant for making insecticides. They knew about flies, but they pleaded ignorance about Saddam's feeling toward Persians and Jews. And Degussa was also involved with helping to arm Saddam Hussein with his nuclear capability as well. More about Degussa and Saddam's new capability from the Death Lobby by Kenneth Timmerman. Two transactions that spring heightened fears that Iraq intended to use the Us-Iraq reactor to produce bomb-grade plutonium. An Italian company, in a semi-clandestine deal, sold Iraq 6 tons of depleted uranium purchased from the West German nuclear consortium, NUKEM. Fearing that NUKEM, N-U-K-E-M, might not deliver the uranium if they knew it was intended for Iraq, the Italians claimed it was for domestic use in Italy. But they needn't have worried about NUKEM's scruples. The consortium was a wholly owned subsidiary of the German chemicals giant Degussa, which had invented and manufactured Zyklon B, the powerful cyanide gas that streamed out of the showerheads in Hitler's death camps, killing millions of European Jews. Degussa had also played a key role in the Nazi effort to build an atom bomb, stopped only when its Oranienburg works near Berlin were flattened by U.S. bombers in 1945. That same year, as the Third Reich was going up in flames, Degussa's chairman, Hermann Schlosser, donated 45,000 Reichmarks to Hitler's SS. 35 years later, Schlosser, S-C-H-L-O-S-S-E-R, was still on the Degussa board, and in 1987 he was awarded the German Federal Merit Cross for his services to industry. One of Schlosser's services was shipping nuclear equipment and materials to almost every developing nation that was known to have a clandestine bomb program. Another was opening the vast Iraqi market to German firms. His readiness to supply nuclear materials to both India and Pakistan had impressed on Saddam Hussein that this was a man he could do business with. Only months after the triangular deal with Italy, NUKEM offered to sell the Iraqis even more uranium. The deal would have gone through if it hadn't been for alert regulatory officials in the United States and Canada, who suspected NUKEM of hiding the real identity of its client. When they learned that the fuel pins were destined for Iraq, they blocked a sale. As one of the officials who worked on the case was quick to point out, quote, "This came from the same people who brought us Zyklon B," unquote. And skipping down, "The very existence of a weapons industry in West Germany was a closely guarded secret all through the 1950s and 1960s. As the years went by, most of the same technology concerns that had helped build Hitler's Third Reich were born again from the ashes of World War II." And by the way, one of the main reasons for that was their cartel agreements with many of their American counterparts in this transatlantic financial and industrial axis. By the way, the relationship between NUKEM, Degussa, and I.G. Farben discussed in a miscellaneous archive show entitled South Africa, the Third Reich, and the Bomb, that available from Spitfire. By the way, the address, etc. for Spitfire, Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. The email address is alcalame, that's alcalame, at ix.netcom.com. You can check out a list of and description of the various programs available from Spitfire on the interactive KFJC website. Point your web browser at www.kfjc.org. Once again, www.kfjc.org, and look in the public affairs section. That concludes this half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.